service.
Hey guys, this is Jake, and I want to tell you about a brand new podcast from my company Double Elvis in collaboration with Volume.com called The Singer's Talk. This show is based on the book of the same name written by Jason Thomas Gordon, the singer and drummer for the LA rock band King Size. And just like the book, The Singer Talk podcast features in-depth, illuminating conversations with some of the most iconic singers of all time, discussing the one thing they're never asked about, their voices. So whether you're a singer or a music fan, you're going to get a wild inside look at how your favorite vocalists approach singing live and in the studio. This is a fascinating podcast. These are raw, intimate conversations with incredible artists like Thom Yorke, Norah Jones, Roger Daltrey, Geddy Lee, and so many more. Also, interviews with bandmates and producers of singers that are no longer with us, like Prince, Janis Joplin, Chris Cornell, and Nina Simone. That's The Singer's Talk. You can search for it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, you know the drill, wherever you get your podcasts. Give it a follow or check it out on volume.com/The Singer's Talk. Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll. Badlands is a production of Double Elvis.
We shall show you in this film typical examples of children who have been well brought up, the kind who grow up to be strong, healthy, and happy, like these young folk. Sturdy growth, joyousness, contentment in life, and vigorous health for the children of today will build men and women of tomorrow with strength of body, nerve, and mind, and thus a better chance to get the most out of life.
The stories about Natalie Wood are insane. Her death in 1981 at the age of 43 was originally ruled an accidental drowning, but has long been considered mysterious. So mysterious that the case was officially reopened 30 years later. She was forced into a career as a child star by a mother who thought it was her destiny to become famous. She went on to make unprecedented deals for a woman in mid-20th century Hollywood and unprecedented amounts of money. She did this all while silently tortured by fears of water, of gypsy curses, even of sex and of childbirth. And Natalie Wood made great films. Unlike that clip I played for you at the top of the show, that wasn't a great film. That was a fair use sample from the Library of Congress of a 1941 U.S. Department of Agriculture film titled For Health and Happiness. I played you that clip because I can't afford the rights to sample Terry Gilliam's film, Time Bandits. And why would I play you that specific slice of Monty Python adjacent celluloid cheese could I afford it? Because that was the number one movie in America on November 29, 1981. And that was the day that Natalie Wood's body was found floating in the Pacific Ocean, off the coast of Santa Catalina Island, some 8 hours after she'd gone missing. On this episode, mysteries, prophecies, fears, Monty Python adjacent celluloid, and the immortal Natalie Wood. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is Badlands, Season 1, Hollywoodland. The voice on the other end of the phone didn't have any time for pleasantries. "Gimme Noguchi," the voice said in a low rasp. The voice was gruff, irritable, fresh out of fucks. And the receptionist at the Los Angeles County Coroner's Office asked who was calling and what the call was regarding, just like she had been trained when she was first hired. "Noguchi," the voice repeated. The man on the other end of the line wasn't asking, he was telling. It was clear to the receptionist by the snub-nosed tone of voice that the caller was of the East Coast variety, New Jersey most likely. She put him on hold, even though it was also clear that he was the kind of man who didn't want to be put on hold. It was December, 1981. The receptionist found Thomas Noguchi, L.A. County's chief medical examiner, hard at work in his office. She patched the call into his phone and told him it was urgent. Noguchi was poring over photos related to the dead body he was currently investigating. That of actress Natalie Wood, 43 years old, found drowned in the ocean near Santa Catalina Island, 20 miles off the coast of California. She'd been found floating in the ocean around breakfast time on Sunday, November 29th, roughly 8 hours after she'd gone missing from the Splendor, the 55-foot yacht she co-owned with her husband, actor Robert Wagner. Noguchi flipped through the photos for the umpteenth time. Empty liquor bottles and beer bottles strewn through each frame, clothes randomly tossed on the furniture, Natalie's purse on the floor. Noguchi picked up the receiver and knew the voice right away. The voice on the phone was not just a voice, it was the voice, as in capital T, capital V. The voice, aka the chairman, aka old blue eyes, Francis Albert Sinatra. And now that the voice got the coroner on the horn, he made it clear he not only had no time for pleasantries, he also had no time for some scalpel-wielding herb. "Noguchi had some set of balls on him," Sinatra bellowed. "He told the press that Natalie was drunk. He told them that the boys were arguing, and now there's talk of an affair." Sinatra was practically spitting into the phone. Noguchi couldn't even get a word in. He just took the beating. "And what the hell is a psychological autopsy?" Sinatra wanted to know. That wasn't even a real thing. Sinatra had news for Noguchi. He was done. Shut it down. The whole thing. Ensville, baby. She slipped. She fell. She drowned. Case closed. On the one hand, the case did seem open and shut. Natalie Wood, the former child actress who quickly became an audience favorite in a bygone era of contract stars in the mid-20th century, beloved for her roles in Miracle on 34th Street, Rebel Without a Cause, and West Side Story, may have simply had a terrible accident. And that terrible accident could have been caused by the 7 or 8 glasses of wine she drank that night. She may have slipped off the side of her boat, hit her head, and drowned in the Pacific under moonlight. And by the time the other people on the boat, her husband, along with actor Christopher Walken and skipper Dennis Davern, noticed she was missing, it was too late. Noguchi saw no immediate evidence of foul play. It was a similar scenario to the one that had played out just weeks earlier, when actor William Holden had too much to drink, slipped, hit his head, and bled out on the floor of his apartment in Santa Monica. Noguchi ruled that an accident. But on the other hand, Noguchi had been briefed that a rather spirited argument had preceded Natalie's disappearance that Saturday night in November. The argument was between Wagner and Walken, Natalie's co-star in her new film, Brainstorm, who was a guest aboard the couple's yacht for Thanksgiving weekend. Noguchi was further briefed that there were rumors that Natalie and Walken were having an affair, and perhaps that was a secret that led to further truths about what exactly happened to Natalie Wood that fateful evening. Noguchi knew all about secrets. He had spent 2 decades uncovering secrets on his autopsy table. 1962, the secret of Marilyn Monroe's addiction to pills and probable suicide. 1968, the secret of the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, which seemed to suggest a gunman in addition to Saran Saran. 1970, the secret of the batch of white China heroin that Janis Joplin skin popped in a hotel on Franklin Avenue. Perhaps, Noguchi thought, there was a secret here, too. A secret he wasn't seeing right off the bat. Why would Natalie Wood suddenly separate herself from her husband and her friend in the middle of the ocean? Why would Natalie Wood, who had a profoundly deep-seated fear of water and drowning, walk to the edge of the boat in her nightgown alone? Why would her husband, Robert Wagner, wait for nearly 2 hours after he noticed she'd gone missing to actually do something about it? And thus, a few days before Old Blue Eyes got him on the horn, Noguchi announced at a press conference that he was planning a quote-unquote psychological autopsy to determine just what happened prior to Natalie's disappearance. That's when Sinatra draped his pinstripe jacket on the back of a chair at his house in Beverly Hills, sat down, crossed one pinstripe pant leg on top of the other, and dialed the number for the LA County coroner. Sinatra told Noguchi that he was wading into waters where he didn't belong, revealing that Natalie was drunk, that Wagner and Walken were arguing. These were all secrets, Hollywood secrets, secrets that were supposed to remain secret. Noguchi was a fink. Sinatra reminded Noguchi that he worked at the pleasure of guys like Sinatra, and Sinatra was not pleased. Thanks in part to Sinatra's displeasure, there was no psychological autopsy, and there was no investigation, period. 2 weeks after her body was found, the sheriff's department closed the case. And almost immediately thereafter, Noguchi found himself without the title Chief Medical Examiner after his name for the first time in 14 years. And why did a guy like Frank Sinatra give enough of a shit to clam up old-fashioned police work and get a hardworking guy fired? And why the hell would Frank Sinatra get involved in the investigation of Natalie Wood's murder? The answer to that question is another Hollywood secret. Frank Sinatra first met Natalie Wood with her mother Maria on the Warner's lot in Los Angeles. It was 1954. They were both already Hollywood royalty. Sinatra boasted a new gold statuette on his shelf for his supporting role in From Here to Eternity. And Natalie was the child star of the day, a household name ever since her breakout role as a Santa skeptic in the sleeper hit Miracle on 34th Street. Sinatra was charmed, Natalie was starstruck. Sinatra invited Natalie and Maria back to his place for a party, some clam bake or something, and Maria excused herself but encouraged Natalie to go alone. Natalie wore a black dress and was quickly enveloped by swirls of smoke from unfiltered Camel cigarettes and bubbles from bottomless glasses of champagne. Sinatra was 38, Natalie was 15. Frank Sinatra's affair with an underage Natalie Wood was kept way under the radar. It was the kind of scandal that, had the gossip columnist sniffed it out, could ruin careers and maybe even send someone to jail. But for Maria, not just Natalie's mother, but her self-appointed Svengali, it was a wise career move for the daughter, who was the sole breadwinner for the entire family. Sinatra had power. In Maria's mind, the best way for Natalie to gain power was to put her in bed with the powerful. Sinatra also knew how to cover his tracks, and he kept his nose clean. They called him Lady Macbeth behind his back on account of how type A he was when it came to personal hygiene. The spot came out if Frank commanded the spot to come out. So when a secret needed to remain a secret, like an affair between a powerful man and an impressionable underage girl some 20 years his junior, Frank made sure all lips were sealed. Sinatra's relationship with Natalie turned into that of godfather protecting his interest, not to mention protecting his own ass. He had her tailed every time she took a more appropriately aged boy out on a date. He pulled Robert Wagner aside when, years later, Robert took Natalie as his wife and told him all Sonny Corleone style, "If you ever hurt her, you'll have to answer to me." Surely, Maria thought, with the help of a man like Frank Sinatra, her daughter could achieve her wildest dreams. But Natalie Wood's dreams were not like other people's. They were dark places full of superstition, paranoia, and fatal premonitions. And one day, the horrible things in her dreams would come true. The rain came down sideways. The wind howled. Despite the onslaught of the elements, the girl made her way through the darkness. The bunny suit she wore was soaked through to the bone. Her pigtails were coming undone. She had to lean into the wind just to stay upright. Up ahead, she could see the wooden footbridge. It was a short bridge and offered safe passage over a narrow section of river. She placed her hands on a railing and took a deep breath. Her heart pounded. She tried not to look down at the water. Dark things hid in the dark water. Her mother's voice echoed in the back of her mind. Stay away from water. Water is death. Lightning struck a nearby telephone pole right as the girl placed a foot on the first board of the wooden bridge. She panicked. The second step she took was slippery, the river lapping at her feet. On the third step, wet and rotten boards gave out, and the girl tumbled into the river. The water threatened to swallow her whole. She reached out with her left hand to grab one of the posts on the footbridge and felt her wrist snap. She clung to the post, the river still trying to drag her down to darkness. Her left wrist stung like hell. And then she looked down. The dark water below her was swirling, twisting up around a large rock. She thought she could see something in the water, right below the surface. She held onto the post tighter and narrowed her eyes. Whatever was below the surface was struggling to move, struggling to get out. And as the girl kept her gaze at the dark water, the river rose up on either side of the large rock, like two long arms outstretched. And the river's long arms swept towards the girl from either side, and within the time it takes for thunder to crack, she was pulled under. Natalie Wood woke up screaming in bed. Thunder echoed outside her bedroom window. She looked down at her left hand and saw the misshapen wrist, one of the two constant reminders. The protruding bone made it look twice the size of her other wrist. The other constant reminder was the dream. Every time she had it, it felt so real. Because it was real. Natalie was only 9 years old when she crossed the wooden bridge in a bunny suit for a climactic scene in The Green Promise, a low-budget RKO picture from 1948. Airplane propellers threw biblical weather at her, point blank. And the bridge was rigged to collapse once Natalie was safely across, but the lever was accidentally pulled too soon and she fell. She really did break her left wrist. And every night thereafter, when she was tucked into bed, she feared that she would have to relive the moment over again in her dreams. Her mother, Maria, kept it hush-hush. She never took Natalie to a doctor because Maria didn't believe in doctors. And for the rest of her life, Natalie would keep the injury a secret. She wore large cuff bracelets or gloves to hide the glaring imperfection of her poorly healed wrist. And it wasn't just her wrist. Her whole life was shrouded in secrets. From the moment she was born in San Francisco in 1938, even her real name was a secret. Natalie Wood was born Natalia Nikolaevna Nakarenko to Russian immigrants, but her mother always called her Natasha. Natalie Wood was a necessary Americanization given to her by producers when Maria made the decision that her second born would have a career in Hollywood. Maria controlled what Natalie did and also what Natalie believed. Maria told her beloved Natasha that they were descendants of the Romanovs, the royal Russian family. In reality, Maria's peasant family fled her home and then the motherland when the Bolshevik Revolution literally came to their front door. They jumped the Trans-Siberian Railroad bound for the city of Harbin in China before traveling by boat to San Francisco. It was in Harbin that Maria said a gypsy read her fortune. The gypsy told Maria two things. Her secondborn would be famous and she would one day drown in dark water. Gypsy curses were the least of young Natalie's worries. Maria passed on her old world neurosis and kept Natalie terrified of just about everything. Water would kill her, so she never learned how to swim. Kidnappers would take her and sell her to communists, so Natalie would go home alone. And God forbid, if she became pregnant, the process of giving birth would surely kill her, if dark water hadn't killed her already. Broken mirrors, hats on beds, shoes on tables, they were all bad news. Maria's scare tactics knew no bounds. She once pulled Natalie aside during a screen test and made her daughter watch as she tore the wings off a living butterfly in order to get her to cry on cue. Maria wasn't the only one pulling den mother power moves. Traumatizing child stars was something old Hollywood specialized in. MGM drugged a teenage Judy Garland with amphetamines on the set of The Wizard of Oz to keep her thin and full of energy. Child stars like Shirley Temple, the biggest box office draw in the late 30s, were forced to sit on blocks of ice in a room with no windows as punishment for running around and doing the things that little kids do while the adults are trying to work. But whatever the studios wanted, they got. The old studio system kept many prized actors under exclusive contract. They owned the actors, and they didn't just own their time on screen, but their private lives too. When to go out, when to be home, what to wear, who to be seen with. Every decision in a contracted star's life was made for them. For Natalie Wood, the studios made up their minds that she would forever be the little girl. but by 15 years old, she no longer could pass for the precocious Santa skeptic in Miracle on 34th Street. Hollywood, in its infinite yet myopic wisdom, couldn't see her as anything else. So one of the biggest stars in Hollywood stopped getting roles. Maria couldn't have her family's meal ticket without a role. If Natalie didn't work, the family didn't eat. So Maria turned a blind eye when older men like Frank Sinatra came calling. She let those powerful players usher Natalie into adulthood, and in return, they'd ensure her career carried on. After Sinatra came Nicholas Ray. Ray was 43 years old at the time, more than 25 years her senior, and was directing a new film called Rebel Without a Cause. Natalie desperately wanted the role of Judy, not only so she could act alongside the king of cool, James Dean, but so she could shed the little girl roles for good and break bad. Ray convinced Natalie to sleep with him before he had made up his mind on whether or not she had the part. It wasn't long before another powerful actor in Hollywood came calling. Unlike Ray, this one was married. He was in his 30s. He invited Natalie to his hotel suite to have her read for a big part in a big picture. The room was dark when she entered. It was quiet, but she could hear the wind blowing outside. It pawed at the floor-to-ceiling windows. She closed the door behind her and began to make her way into the room, her feet cushioned by the plush carpet. And the actor was sitting all the way at the other end of the room in a chair against the window, his body silhouetted in the darkness by the vibrant glow of Los Angeles at night outside. He was smoking a cigarette. His face glowed red every time he took a drag. It didn't take Natalie all that long before she realized what was actually happening. He didn't want her to read, and there was no script, there was no part. There was just the two of them, in the dark. He wanted her to take her clothes off, and then he would do the thing the powerful men in Hollywood did. And it was going to happen whether or not Natalie wanted it to or not. Natalie felt herself pulled into the current of the river. She could only hold on to that bridge post for so long. Her left wrist began to ache, and she hoped in vain, behind closed eyes, that it was all just a dream. But when it was over, Natalie limped back through the suite to the door. The powerful actor reminded her that if she ever told anyone about what happened, then he would personally see to it that she would never work again. Her family would starve, and her life would be over. His word was her new prophecy. That night, like most nights, Natalie took all of her secrets to bed with her, where they remained hidden. But she couldn't keep the memories and the paranoia out of her dreams, where every night they would wait until she was asleep, and then rear their ugly heads. Natalie reached over to the nightstand next to her bed and fumbled around looking for her sleeping pills. The pills had become part of her nightly routine, as regular as brushing her teeth. And the more she took, the longer she could hold the secrets at bay.
We'll be right back after this word.
Los Angeles, the day after Thanksgiving. The pills were strewn all over the duvet cover. Secanols, Dexedrines, Nembutal, Dexatrim. At first, it had just been sleeping pills, but that was back when she was a teenager. Now, as an adult, Natalie Wood needed more than just sleeping pills. It was harder than ever to escape. She didn't just need sleep. She needed peace. So she diversified. Reds, blues, uppers, downers. The usual bedtime cocktail was a little bit of this, a little bit of that, something to usher in a deep sleep, pronto, and then something else to keep all the bad things out of her head while she was under. It was reds she took. She swallowed a handful and then a handful more, and she knew it was too many. She chased them with room temperature white wine. She couldn't get Warren Beatty out of her head. That fuck. They weren't dating while they were making Splendor in the Grass together with director Elia Kazan, even though the gossip columns worked overtime to prove otherwise. Their affair started afterward when she had separated from her husband. They had been together a few years when Beatty snuck out the back door at Chasen's on Beverly Boulevard with some hat-checked bimbo, left Natalie alone at the table. She figured she was totally in the right when she went home, poured lighter fluid on his clothes, and tossed a lit match on top. Then she thought about Robert Wagner, aka RJ, who she thought about often. He was supposed to be her knight in shining armor, a golden god of old Hollywood. He turned out to be something else entirely. He was Natalie's fantasy husband first. when she was 11 and saw him as a young man on set. And then he became her real husband, her first husband, in 1957. But the fantasy-turned-reality marriage only lasted 4 years. And the reality, hiding below the glossy surface, sheltered in a mansion filled with the finest of the fine, was just too much for Natalie to process. The reality was there, behind a closed door, a door that Natalie opened late one night when she feared RJ had up and vanished. She searched for him throughout their house and eventually found him behind that door. And he wasn't alone. The trauma of that memory was added to all the other traumas in her unconscious mind on that day after Thanksgiving in 1964. The irrational fears of drowning and childbirth, the memories of car accidents up on Mulholland that one time with Dennis Hopper, and then again in the Hollywood Hills on her own, the violent rape at the hands of a powerful actor. She wanted it to all go away, thus the pills. And after she had knocked the handfuls back with the tepid white wine, she picked up the phone and dialed her friend, playwright Mark Crowley. She told him about the Reds. She told him what she had done. And then she closed her eyes and let herself get pulled under. Natalie's multiple overdoses in the 60s, whether they were actually suicide attempts or desperate cries for help, didn't make the juicy gossip columns of Hepa Hopper. Pills, aka Mother's Little Helpers, ran rampant throughout the nightstands of the Hollywood elite, even if their rampant abuse rarely made the nightly news. Marilyn Monroe's death in 1962 took the dirty little pills public. Secrets like those were the dark water of Hollywood, and if the movie-going, tabloid-reading public looked too closely at them, they could see things they never wanted to see. Natalie could relate. According to her sister Lana, Natalie never let the secret get out that she had found her husband, RJ, Robert Wagner, in the arms of another man. Though Wagner has denied this ever since the incident supposedly took place in the early 60s, Natalie was so crushed by the incident she couldn't even bring herself to write it down. In a draft of an abandoned memoir discovered long after her death, Natalie only alluded to the incident as reality crushing the fragile web of romantic fantasies with sledgehammer force. That's a quote. When she saw what she saw behind the door that night, she gasped and tripped backwards over herself. She walked determinedly towards the kitchen and felt as though a violent wind had just begun blowing in her face. She had to lean into it just to stay upright. She took a crystal wine glass from the cabinet. She stood there, holding the crystal, running her fingers over the etching, feeling the wind attack her face. It was howling now, her ears filled with static. Her hand began to shake and her fingers became tighter around the crystal. She could hear the shouts of men somewhere behind the bluster of the wind, RJ's voice perhaps, and someone else's. Her nightgown suddenly felt wet and heavy, like it was soaked through to the bone. She gritted her teeth and heard the grind of enamel on enamel in her head. Her grip on the crystal became tighter. She squeezed so hard that the glass shattered in her hand, and the pieces cut into her palm, and the blood ran down her arm and dripped onto the kitchen floor. She didn't remember calling her mother or running to her parents' house in nothing but her nightgown or the handfuls of pills she took that night. And the hospital staff in Los Angeles recognized the unconscious patient in the ER as the ultimate manifestation of silver screen fame in haute couture fashion. They had a queen in their midst, a queen that they not only revived but kept alive. In the 1960s, Natalie Wood was the queen. They actually called her the queen of the Warner's lot. And it was there that she outran the little girl image and fought to be accepted by Hollywood and audiences in grown-up roles like Deanie in Splendor in the Grass, Louise in Gypsy, and Maria in the big screen adaptation of the popular Broadway musical West Side Story. West Side Story in particular was a huge get for Natalie Wood. And not just because she was a white woman playing the part of a Puerto Rican. Hell, Mickey Rooney, John Wayne, Marlon Brando, and Katharine Hepburn had all paved the way for cringeworthy, culturally insensitive casting choices by that point. It was the fact that after one of the largest screen test searches in Hollywood history to cast the role of Maria, it was awarded to Natalie Wood, along with an unprecedented $250,000 payday. Even more unprecedented was in 1966, after numerous iconic roles, award nominations, and clandestine overdoses, Natalie decided to sever her contract with Warner Brothers and walk away. She cut a check for $175,000 to buy herself out. At 28 years old, she was free. It was the first time in two decades that she wasn't needed on the set the next morning. And for the next 6 years, she would act in only one film, Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, a groundbreaking look at the sexual revolution in 1969. Instead of taking her usual fee of $750,000, she took only 50 grand up front and 15 points in the film. The shrewd business move reportedly made her upwards of $3 million. After a second failed marriage to London agent Richard Gregson and numerous relationships and engagements, Natalie married RJ for a second time in 1972. Surprising as it may have been, the years of calm and domesticity had helped her to move beyond many of the traumas and curses of her past. She wasn't relying on pills to get her through the night. She had conquered fears and moved on. She was even willing to pretend that RJ's illicit tryst, one that he would continue to publicly refute throughout the years, never happened. Fuck prophecies and fuck what anyone else thought. They were a Hollywood power couple, and they were meant to be. Natalie would make it so. She even moved on beyond her fear of dark water, and she and RJ bought their 55-foot yacht, Splendor, named for Natalie's 1961 film. She began to stage a comeback in Hollywood and surprised many when she shifted from the big screen to the TV screen, a trailblazing move that many other A-list actors would make in the decades to come. In a 1979 feature article in Look magazine, Natalie was hailed as, quote, Hollywood's number one survivor, one of the rare former child actors who, quote, fought her demons and won. She had it all, fame, money, children, her fairy tale old Hollywood prince, happiness. Again, she had put the secrets of the past behind her. She left them in the wake of the Splendor as it cast off the coast of California. Thanksgiving weekend, 1981. Destination, one of her and RJ's favorite spots, Santa Catalina Island. One of the Harbin Gypsy's prophecies had come true. Natalie was famous. She was loved the world over. And she didn't let the other prophecy frighten her anymore. There was no angry phone call from Frank Sinatra when the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department reopened the investigation into Natalie Wood's death in 2011. The voice was silent. Old Blue Eyes had been dead for over a decade. The coroner's official cause of death was changed from accidental drowning to drowning in other undetermined factors. Some choose to interpret the other undetermined factors part as an admission by the authorities that there was more to this case than a simple accident. Perhaps Thomas Noguchi, the LA County medical examiner, had been onto something after all way back in 1981. And perhaps Natalie Wood's death was more than just a careless or a drunken slip and fall off the side of a yacht in the middle of the night. Perhaps someone else was responsible for her death. But who? Her husband, Robert Wagner? Her co-star, Christopher Walken? The boat's private captain, Dennis Davern? Or was it someone else? That Thanksgiving weekend wasn't exactly a relaxing getaway. Tensions ran high. Jealousy lurked around every corner. Alcohol fueled the fire. Conversations quickly turned to arguments. Where should they moor the boat? Should they stay overnight on the Splendor or in town on the island? And where should they eat? What should they eat? And why is Christopher Walken even here? What exactly do you want, Chris? RJ reportedly barked at one point, right around the time he smashed a wine bottle over a table in the boat's salon. What do you want to do? Fuck my wife? And that particular exchange was one that Dennis Davern didn't divulge at first. It came out later, though, after years of harbored secrets took their toll on Davern's conscience. Thus, for some, the whole other determined factors, part of the revised cause of death became simply other secrets. The real story was bubbling under that highly produced Hollywood narrative. The questions first raised by Thomas Noguchi exactly 30 years prior were still unanswered, and the circumstances surrounding Natalie's death remained strange. Christopher Walken was the first to lawyer up when the case was reopened in 2011. He had his own secrets, the secrets of what he and Natalie Wood talked about on the set of Brainstorm, the film that would unknowingly be her last. Fresh off an Oscar win for The Deer Hunter, Walken was skeptical of Hollywood, of its gossip and its greed. He was a window into the soul of New York City theater, a callback to the method men of Natalie's youth. Was Natalie tempted to leave behind the big-budget world of Hollywood glamour to reconnect with her raw acting roots? Or was there something else going on? Something that would cause Walken and RJ to argue the way they did, according to Dennis Davern, anyway. Davern, who had been Natalie and RJ's private captain since 1975, had his own secrets. Shortly after Natalie's death, Davern got himself an attorney, RJ's. He later told Vanity Fair that he didn't speak the truth about what happened on the Splendor that night because he was under RJ's thumb. RJ put him up at his house for months. They drank together, went to therapy together. What the fuck was that about? RJ even drafted a statement detailing exactly what happened on the night of November 28, 1981, and Davern signed it. RJ's story became Davern's story. Davern's conscience, however, wasn't so thick-skinned. He was haunted by his own secrets. They came to him in dreams, just like Natalie's had haunted hers. He dreamed of shouting matches aboard the Splendor. He dreamed of smashed wine bottles and hurled threats. He dreamed of a man pushing Natalie Wood into the ocean. He dreamed of the thing that people with secrets dream about, the fear of being found out and the fear of being ruined. One evening, years later, he woke from one of his dreams and drunk dialed Natalie's younger sister, Lana. He hadn't slept off that night's scotch yet, and his words were slurred as he told Lana that he had to tell her exactly what happened that night in November 1981. He needed to tell her so that the secrets would stop finding him in his sleep. When the sun came up and Davern sobered up, he refused to repeat the secrets he had revealed the night before. And then there was John Payne. John Payne had his own secrets. His boat, the Capricorn, was moored 80 feet from the Splendor. And around 11 p.m., the time Natalie supposedly went missing, Payne claims he heard a woman's voice. "Please help me, I'm drowning." And then he heard other voices, the voices of men laughing, voices of men pretending to care. He wasn't 100% sure that one of those voices was RJ's. RJ, Robert Wagner, has spoken very little of what happened that night. But when he has, he echoes the verdict delivered by the chairman of the board all those years ago. She slipped, she fell, she drowned. Case closed. Endsville, baby. No one has ever been charged with a crime in connection with Natalie Wood's death. The case remains open. And even though many suspicious details have surfaced over the years, and the accounts of people like Dennis Davern and John Payne have added to a splintered narrative that feels like it was cribbed straight from Rashomon, the hard truth remains that the biggest secrets went into the water that evening with Natalie Wood. And they floated away from the Splendor, under the cover of moonlight, along an isthmus to just about 150 yards off Blue Cavern Point, a kelp forest off the coast of Santa Catalina Island. It was there that the secrets drowned along with Natalie Wood, suspended beneath her red down jacket that kept her buoyed at the top of the water. Secrets so explosive, they ought to be in pictures. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is Badlands. Badlands was created by me, Jake Brennan, and produced by Double Elvis. Credits for this episode can be found on the show notes page at badlandspod.com. Subscribe, follow, like, rate, and review the Badlands podcast wherever you get your podcast, because Badlands is available everywhere. If you love this show, tell someone, tell everyone, shout us out on social, spread the word, and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Double Elvis.